Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Welcome to another edition of the Fundamental Health Podcast. Got an exciting one for you this week that I can't wait to tell you about. And as always, I am super excited about what we are doing at Heart and Soil. As you guys heard in my conversation with Joel Fuhrman, as you've heard me talk about so many times, I am absolutely convinced that meat and organs are the most nutritious, most nutrient-rich food for humans, and that we are being told by the mainstream that these are bad for us and we should exclude them or limit them. And I'm going the completely opposite way, saying most of us, the majority of us, are not getting enough animal foods, especially organs. On my lives, I always hear this. I always talk about it. We are not getting enough organs. Our ancestors ate nose to tail. The Hadza eat nose to tail. Eating nose to tail, getting liver, heart, kidney, spleen, pancreas, all these organs, bone meal in your diet, collagen, trachea and scapula collagen. These are key to optimal human health. These are what our ancestors have always eaten. They've always prized these things. And yet it's hard to get these foods, which is why I created Heart and Soil. So if you need more organs in your life, and invariably the answer is likely yes. And if you don't want to eat the fresh organs, which are great, but if you can't get them or you don't like the taste of liver, check us out at heartandsoil.co. I strongly believe that getting the nutrition from eating animals nose to tail will help you reclaim your ancestral birthright to radical health, because you really have that birthright. You possess a birthright to be freaking radically healthy, to have the body that you desire, to have the mental clarity that you desire, the libido that you desire, the sleep that you desire, the emotional poise, the creativity. These things stem from our nutritional basis, and getting organs in your life, I believe so strongly, will help with that. We hear it all the time. Thousands of testimonials, thousands of comments on our stuff. Guys, this will change your perspective on life when you get these organs that are missing from our diets. So check us out, heartandsoil.co, and reclaim your ancestral birthright to radical health. We recently released Skin, Hair, and Nails. I'm super excited about this one. It's one of my favorite ones we've ever released. It's trachea and scapula cartilage. These are special types of cartilage studied by John Pruden that have been shown to help with immunity, tissue regeneration. It's not just the regular cartilage or the collagen, quote unquote, that you get from hides and hooves. This is special collagen mixed with liver and bone marrow. What a powerful combination to help with your skin, your hair, your nails, your bones, your joints. Check it out, heartandsoil.co. I know it's going to improve your life, the life of your friends, your family, your kids. It's why I do what I do. This conversation with Will Cole is also why I do what I do. I get to hang out and talk to really good people doing amazing things. And it was really fun to talk to Will. He's been on the podcast once before, about intermittent fasting. It's something you guys have heard me about, but I get a lot of questions. When do you eat? How much do you eat? We talk about it in this podcast, and we share important data about the microbiome, increased concentrations of Akkermansia, and other beneficial flora that happen, increased concentrations of bacteria when we fast, when you intermittent fast. And guess what? Fasting is the ultimate zero fiber diet. So I don't know how anyone can claim that we absolutely need fiber for a healthy microbiome when intermittent fasting leads to improvements in some of the known beneficial flora in our guts. How cool is that? So if you want to get fiber in your diet, be careful with it. I think too much can cause a lot of problems for people. Some fiber is probably easier to digest than others, as you guys have heard me talk about. I think fiber from fruit is probably easier for us than fiber from grains or beans or nuts and seeds or leafy greens. These are not plant foods that I think we should be eating a lot of as humans or any of, but enjoy this podcast with Will Cole. I want to also give a shout out to my sponsors. Thank you always to White Oak Pastures. This is the sixth generation family farm in Bluffton, Georgia, doing regenerative agriculture, really leading the way in regenerative agriculture. These are the guys who essentially initiated it, popularized it, and I'm so happy to support them. It's an amazing, beautiful farm. You can check them out, whiteoakpastures.com, grass-fed, grass-finished meat, beef, lamb, chicken, duck, turkey, guinea, pork. Their chickens are even soy and corn-free. They have soy and corn-free chicken options because we asked and they did it for us. They have all kinds of amazing stuff. They are really good people. And this is the type of agriculture that we should be supporting because it will ensure the health of the soil and that will ensure the health of future generations. The animals are treated properly. They're healthier and they nourish you more. You can get organs there fresh or you can get desiccated organs from us at Hardened Soil. So check them out, whiteoakpastures.com. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 10% off your first order. Also, I love supporting these regenerative farms, Belcampo in Northern California, belcampo.com, B-E-L-C-A-M-P-A-O, C-A-M-P-O, not P-A-O. Anya Fernald, the CEO of Belcampo, has been on the podcast. She's amazing. They do meat camps in the summer. We're about to run a co-promotion sweepstakes with Belcampo, so stay tuned for that. And they are doing grass-fed, grass-finished, regenerative agriculture, certified organic beef in Northern California at the base of Mount Shasta. You can get 20% off your order at Belcampo using the code CARNIVOREMD on their website. I love their Bavette steaks. They have some amazing liver and suet. You can get heart and organs. They're amazing people. And we're going to partner with them at Hardened Soil and do a big giveaway, a big sweepstakes. So stay tuned for the sweepstakes with Belcampo. We're going to be giving away a year of free Belcampo meat and a year of Hardened Soil supplements. Stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, check them out, belcampo.com. CarnivoreMD will get you 20% off there. Again, you'll be supporting regenerative agriculture and doing good for yourself, your family, the planet. This is the way we're meant to eat. And it obviates, it completely destroys all arguments of sustainability, of harming the earth with cows. This is the type of thing we should be promoting and helping everybody understand that cows raised properly are part of an ecosystem. They always have been. This is how we regenerate the soil and continue to live on this earth. So really appreciate what those two farms are doing. Also want to tell you about Helix Sleep. Sleep is so critical. If there's one thing I've been missing in Costa Rica, it's my Helix mattress. So you can go to helixsleep.com/carnivoreMD. They're offering $200 off all mattresses and two free pillows for our listeners, helixsleep.com/carnivoreMD. So what's cool about Helix is they'll do a quiz for you. You can go to their website, helixsleep.com/carnivoreMD. Do a quiz. Are you a side sleeper? Are you a stomach sleeper? Are you a back sleeper? They will customize a mattress for you. They have this DNA for the mattress system and you will get a firm or a soft mattress that will be cooling or what. I am a side sleeper. I like a pretty firm mattress and the mattress that I got from them has been amazing. And I want to try and get them to send it to me in Costa Rica. I'm not sure how we're going to do that, but it's an amazing mattress. And you guys know that sleeping well will change your life. Just like organs will change your life. Good quality meat will change your life. Sleeping well will change your life. So you don't have to take my word for it. They were the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired. Go to helixsleep.com/carnivoreMD. You can take a 2-minute quiz, match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life, guaranteed. They have a 10-year warranty. You get to try it out for 100 nights, risk-free. It's easy. So $200 off all mattresses and two free pillows for our listeners, helixsleep.com/carnivoreMD. And last but not least, I am loving the light here in Costa Rica, which makes me think about red light a lot. If you're looking for a new Juve, I have exciting news. Go to Juve, JOVV.com/Paul. Use the code Paul. You'll get an exclusive discount on Juve's Generation 3.0 devices. Exclusions do apply, limited time only. But you guys know that this podcast is brought to you by Juve Light Therapy, JOOVV. And you've heard me talk about Juve before. When I'm in Texas, I use my Juve every day. I also miss it in Costa Rica. If I could get my Helix mattress and the Juve sent to me here, I'd be all set. Maybe I just need to buy a place and live here. But I have used it at night. It is so calming to get this red light at night. There's something to this. Cytochrome C oxidase in the mitochondria. Something is going on here. It will help you with skin, performance, recovery, sleep optimization. It's pretty powerful stuff. So you guys know about Juve, far and away the leading brand, pioneered the technology, the first to isolate red and near infrared light, made it accessible for affordable in-home use. They've got new devices. They're sleeker and lighter with the same power you've come to expect. The new Juves have some really cool features like Recovery Plus mode, and that uses pulsed near-infrared light technology to give your cells an extra healing boost to optimize the recovery process. They also have Ambient mode, which uses lower light intensity to support sleep and circadian rhythms and help counteract all that crappy artificial blue light that keeps you up at night. They've got easy mounting. It's really awesome that these guys are continuing to improve. So if you're looking for a new one, if you need a new Joovv, J-O-O-V-V, check it out, J-O-O-V-V.com, joovv.com/Paul. Use the code Paul and you'll get an exclusive discount on Joovv's Generation 3.0 devices, and you will appreciate them. You will love them, I know. And if you like this podcast, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, guys. It helps us reach more people. This is how we spread the remembering. It's the good virus. We want to spread the good virus of the remembering to more people so that they understand that they need to remember where they've come from, that they have an ancestral birthright to radical health achieved through all of these things, and change the world for a positive, in a positive way. So leave me a review, Apple Podcasts, Doc. Apple Podcasts, thank you. I give a free copy, signed copy of my book to one lucky person who leaves a review every month as a thank you to all of you for helping me spread this message. This is what I am, believe I am tasked with doing. It is what I feel most alive when I am doing. And it is something that I really enjoy doing and I'm privileged to do it. And I love hearing all of your stories of vitality, strength, vigor, libido, improved body composition, mental clarity, as you get more organs in your diet, whether fresh or desiccated, as you eat more meat, as you get in the light more, as you go play, as you do the things that we are meant to do as humans. This is what hashtag the remembering is about. Thank you for supporting this podcast by leaving me a review. Love you all. On to the podcast. Stay radical. Will Cole, what's up, brother? It's good to have you on.
Hey, buddy. Likewise. Thanks for having me back and nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's always good to see you. I'm recording this one from Costa Rica. So we had a little snafu with time because, you know, Costa Rica's just in this limbo, but it's all good. It's all good, man. So in honor of you, I had my last meal of the day today at 11:45 a.m. So I'm doing a solid intermittent fast because I got up this morning at 6 a.m. and I had three coconuts. I had water from three coconuts and then I went surfing. And then I had some food and then I had a second meal. So I'm doing some intermittent fasting, but I'm still fasting with you because I haven't really talked about this much on the show. So let's just jump in. And you got your new book, which is called Intuitive Fasting, which people should definitely check out. So I've heard you talk about this. I thought this would be a fun place to start. Like, tell me your thoughts on intuitive eating, which is a nice buzzword that gets thrown around a lot right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was definitely, I mean, if you read anything that I've written since 2018 in the books or clinically, just in articles, things I've written over the past decade, my patients know what I'm always talking about is I want there to be a sense of a body awareness and a discernment on what makes you feel great and what foods make you feel really lousy and have a mindfulness and an art to wellness. And I think it's a major component to what I do. So people aren't feeling like, oh, this is so restrictive, this is miserable, it's super arduous. It's not about that. It's about, I love feeling great more than I thought I missed something that made me feel really, really lousy. So this whole concept of intuition and mindfulness around food and wellness is something that's always been part of the conversation. So what I've talked about the concept of intermittent fasting over the course of the last two books because for different reasons. I mean, there's a lot of exciting science around it, but I wanted a deep dive. And I thought, okay, this is how I explain it to my patients. I want people to have a grace and a lightness. I want people to have a flexibility around fasting. Don't feel that more is always better. It's okay to ebb and flow. It's okay to vacillate with these things and not feel tied to something. And you're a failure if you do less fasting and you could show up for yourself on any specific day. Hence the concept and the name intuitive fasting. There's different levels to why I wanted to title it that, but one of it is there is this whole conversation, like you just mentioned, about intuitive eating, and many of the people that are referring to that word, most people actually don't even know the origins of it. They're just saying it because it sounds nice. It's a nice hashtag on social media, but the actual true source of it came from a book in the 90s. So it's about this concept of intuitive eating. And some people within the eating disorder community use it to, whatever, heal their relationship with food. But it's created a lot of people that are, it's been co-opted in many ways by the body positivity movement, which, you know, there's two sides to this argument. There's people that are shaming people, which isn't good. And there's people that are saying, well, let's try to normalize health problems and metabolic disorders. And I think both sides aren't the right way to go down. Like, we shouldn't be shaming people, but we should actually love people enough and say it in a way that says, no, we want you here. We want you to live a long, healthy, vibrant life. And I think that it's a conversation coming from a functional medicine standpoint that I wanted to bring a perspective to this conversation around what the heck does intuitive eating even mean to the average person. And I'm not talking about people with disordered eating disorders. I'm talking about the average person that's like, oh, I'm intuitively eating this food that's going to end up driving inflammation, driving up insulin, driving up chronic health problems. And the question that I'm posing in intuitive fasting is that really your intuition? Is your intuition really leading you to things that fuel type 2 diabetes and triggering chronic inflammation and gut problems and autoimmune problems? I would say no, that's definitely not bringing homeostasis in the body in any way, shape, or form. And we can make it sound nice, but it's beyond it being a vapid soundbite. It's really nothing rooted in physiological health or science.
And I've heard you say something which I thought was really great, which is that if you are metabolically inflexible, which I think is essentially synonymous with insulin resistance and or metabolic dysfunction, your intuition is broken. You cannot go by your intuition. And, you know, perhaps if you are metabolically healthy, but the majority of people are so metabolically inflexible, they're so glucose inflexible, which we're going to talk about today, that to say you're eating intuitively is just a house built on sand, because your homeostasis with glucose is off, you're not metabolically flexible, you're not actually insulin sensitive, you're metabolically dysfunctional, and it doesn't work. So I just wanted to put that out there for people, that if you're not really sound metabolically, you're going to get misled.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're bound by insatiable cravings and hangriness, I mean, we see it time and time again with patients. They want to be whatever, led by their intuition, but their body's actually going to be these things disguise themselves as your intuition. And I want people to have a discernment on what works for their body, what serves them, and have proper signaling pathways. But you have to show up for yourself to build that for yourself. And then you and I both know, when you're in a place of health, even just some semblance of metabolic flexibility, you'll get a greater awareness on food and how it makes you feel. And you'll be able to go longer without eating. Not because it's some restrictive, obsessive thing, but because you're more fat adapted. So that's really what I'm talking about, intuitive fasting. It is a byproduct of metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, I love that. And one of the other things you talked about in the book, which I thought was great, was that fasting is really built into our history as humans. And there are so many religious traditions that have fasting. Talk to me a little bit about that. I think you're totally right. I think fasting is really built into who we are genetically.
Absolutely. So from an ancestral health perspective, I mean, of course, food scarcity is a part of that conversation, and food wasn't always available. And as you talk so much about, and I talk about a lot too, is that this genetic epigenetic mismatch, that the majority of our genetics haven't changed in more than 10,000 years, but yet we're living with this evolutionary genetic epigenetic mismatch. And this chasm is growing by the day, and people are living out of alignment with this how we've evolved over time. So times of fasting is actually encoded in our DNA, and it's part of how we can tap into these pathways that are not very optimized in many ways. And we can start to upregulate and support these in exponential ways with food when we eat a certain way that's incongruent with our biology, but also with times of fasting. And that's where all the science is substantiating something we knew primarily for a long time, that not just from a food scarcity standpoint, but you look at the founders of modern medicine, Hippocrates, Paracelsus, these guys used fasting for their patients, they didn't have any studies, they didn't have randomized controlled trials, they just saw healing happened when these people did this. And now science is catching up with that antiquity, that we're seeing all the cool mechanisms and the pathways of how this is healing people. But also, it wasn't just ancestral. It wasn't just early founders of modern medicine. It was also a spiritual thing too, that you look at every tradition, every indigenous society around the globe that used fasting for both health and spiritual purposes. You look at Islam with Ramadan, Christianity with Lent, Judaism with Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. I mean, every society around the globe used different types of fasting for many different purposes. So it's in our DNA. It's part of early medicine. It's part of our spiritual DNA over time. It's a powerful tool. And that's another reason why I called the book Intuitive Fasting, is because I think we can tap into that primal relationship that humans have with fasting. And I call it in the book Metaphysical Meals. Like, how can we use this time of fasting to go inward, to use it as a meditation, to use fasting as a mindfulness practice? It's nothing new. I'm just trying to have this conversation to get more in alignment with what humans would have done for thousands of years.
Yeah, and I think it's totally true. And what I saw with the Hadza, I just got back from Tanzania, was that they were intermittent fasting.
Yeah, I was going to say, next time you and Anthony Gustin decide to go traipsing around the globe, holler at your boy.
Holler at your boy. We're going to do it. We're going to do it again. Anthony and I were just texting today about this. Yeah, we're going to do it again. But they're definitely intermittent fasting. There's no imperative to get food. They're just kind of hanging out. They'll wander out of camp and go hunt. And sometimes they get a little bit of food. Sometimes they get a lot of food. And there's long periods of the day where they're not eating. They just don't have any food in camp. They don't have refrigerators. They don't have a pantry. They eat the food when they get it most of the time. And so there's long periods where they're not eating. And it could be 18, 20 hours between dinner one night and the next time they get food the next day. Or it could be 8 hours between a morning set of berries and some honey or something. But there are these periods of not eating. And people ask, like, oh, do they do one meal a day? They don't generally do one meal a day. When they get food, they will eat it. But just in the natural world, there is not this constant availability of food. So it makes so much sense that this would work in our genetics, and evolutionarily we see it mirrored in these people who are kind of this model.
Yeah. And isn't it crazy how far we've gone where that is radical to American society? Like, that is automatically the idea of not food on demand is disordered eating. Our ancestors and most of the people around the world would laugh at that statement.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. It's so interesting. So let's dig into some of the benefits here, because you talk about these in your book, and I kind of pulled some studies that we can look at, because I know my audience likes to see the science and I always like to kind of geek out on it. So I pulled this one up first. This one I thought was super interesting, and I'm pretty sure you've seen this one. It's about the Islamic fasting and acromantia. So have you seen this one? This is a pretty interesting one about the changes in acromantia with this basically 17-hour fasting periods per day.
Yeah. And that's a specific subset of intermittent fasting that I wanted to explore in the book. There is a place, let me be very clear with this, there's a place for long multiple day fasts for different therapeutic purposes. And I think they're working with a doctor, a fasting specialist, different clinics that do that. Wonderful. But that study that you just showed, perfect example, this specific subset of intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, just a simple 17-hour fast, and that's week two in the protocol that I put together for people to tap into the cardiometabolic and the acromantia mucinophilia bacterial colonies, supporting these healing pathways between the gut and the brain and cardiometabolic markers. So that is, the scientific literature is rich with these really compelling studies of time-restricted feeding. And it's something that I get to see on an hourly basis with patients, is that people that have these inflammatory GI issues, chronic dysbiosis, inflammatory bowel issues, and metabolic problems too, start to downregulate this dysbiosis, downregulate these chronic inflammatory cascades, and get this stillness in their body, and to quiet that noise that's disguising itself as their intuition. So it's amazing. I mean, when you give the body the chance to do what it wants to do, try to create some homeostasis, the healing capacity, the resilience capacity never gets old for me.
It's fascinating. I just love this idea, because it kind of, it's a little different than the mainstream, right? When people come to us with gut issues, I feel like the narrative they're carrying is, I need to put more things in my gut. I need to put more probiotics. It's the problem is that I haven't figured out the magic probiotic, or I'm not eating enough fiber. And if intermittent fasting isn't the most zero fiber diet there is, I don't know what, you know, I don't know what you could call a more of a zero fiber diet than intermittent fasting, or just a totally zero food diet than intermittent fasting. So I thought this was a really important point to make on the podcast with you, that the resting your gut for 16, 14 hours a day, maybe only even 12 hours a day completely, is probably something that is important for the balance of the gut microbiome. And nobody really talks about that, or not as much as I've heard, because the narratives that I've heard, again, are more probiotics, more prebiotics, more fiber. And this is the completely opposite perspective. They're saying, no, go on the zero fiber, totally fast your way to health diet by doing this. And as we see in the study, which I'll pull up again, these beneficial populations of Akkermansia and other organisms totally change in a positive way when they have this 17-hour fast. So they were talking about specifically Bacteroidetes fragilis, but Akkermansia, and I'll just also mention that Akkermansia is one of these species that sometimes people will question me about and say, don't I need fiber to increase my Akkermansia? So isn't it interesting that you start to see an improvement in Akkermansia with zero fiber, right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I get to see that too with people that don't change their diet much. Most of my patients eat clean by the time they're meeting me, and we start integrating these fasting protocols. And you get to see, we can quantify Akkermansia on stool labs. So it's really amazing to see this resetting of the microbiome. And I talk about different studies throughout the book in this sort of gut resetting the microbiome metropolis that many people have, these overgrowths of these things that are like weeds that overgrow in this gut garden, these gram-negative bacteria that are higher in lipopolysaccharides, and they have all of this dysbiosis issues and things like SIBO and SIFO and these bacterial and fungal overgrowths. And it is this reset. And the some of the studies around microbiome balance, that I agree, the conversation around microbiome, circadian rhythm and fasting's connection with the microbiome, the circadian rhythm. And it's something that I think we should talk more about, because there's a lot of digestive problems. There's a lot of immune mediated issues in our world today. And this is home to the most of our immune system. And certain colonies of bacteria are higher in the morning, some are higher in the evening. And most people's circadian rhythm of their microbiome is off because of the way we're eating and how much we're eating, and we're never giving our gut a break. So by just these slight time-restricted feeding windows, like the study you just mentioned, just 17 hours can help to reset the microbiome and improve these beneficial flora that are regulating. They are antibiotic in many ways, because they help to regulate some of these opportunistic and pathogenic bacteria. And this doesn't have to do with any caloric restriction either. And people conflate those two. It's just eating in specific windows, giving your gut more of a break. So yeah, it's cool stuff.
It's really cool stuff. And you know, the anti-fiber part of me loves that. It's like not necessarily depleting the mucus layer, that it's probably actually balancing the gut to do some period with no food. And this is the ultimate low fiber diet. I'll just show a couple other studies and then I'll let you dig in here. Go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that I think in many ways, if you look on a macro level and a micro level, the world is begging for a pause. And I think that's oftentimes even the silver lining that people talk about with the pandemic. It's like they're slowing down and they're pausing and they're kind of renegotiating what their priorities are in this life. And I think I see so many parallels on a geopolitical level, on an economic level, but also on a personal physiological level. People are such in dysbiosis, such an imbalance, such chronic inflammation is imbalanced immune activity. And we are in desperate need of a pause. And you're right. We're always looking for the more, 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 or do this, this. It's like, if we just allowed our body a little bit of a pause, we can do profound things. It's not always about adding more. Sometimes it's doing less and giving your body some stillness to calm things down and untangle these inflammatory cascades or these dysregulated pathways. And that word that comes to mind, or the phrase that comes to mind that I quote in the book, is Paracelsus. He's known as the father of toxicology. He was living in the late 1400s, early 1500s in Switzerland. He called fasting the physician within, which I think is just very eloquent way of saying that, is like what we're saying is just giving our body that stillness allows that inner doctor to rise up and to recalibrate. You don't need the next magic pill or like you're saying, focus in all these macronutrients for specific types of foods. Sometimes it's just allowing your body to do its work and have the time to repair and not worry about digesting food all the time.
Yeah, I love it. I totally agree with you. I'll just show these because I gathered them. So the effect of daily fasting hours on shaping the gut microbiota in mice. There's tons of these studies. Many of them, this one again is talking about acromantia. Many of them you're referencing in the book if people want to go get the bibliography there. There's this one too, which is striking as well. Restructuring the gut microbiome by intermittent fasting prevents retinopathy and prolonged survival in DBDB mice. These are sort of these leptin-resistant mouse model of diabetes. And you can see just changing their feeding intervals. And they talk about these bile acids, especially neuroprotective bile acids like TUDCA, Tororo, Dioso, Oxycholate. I'm just going to butcher that one. But, you know, you get the idea here. There's some pretty cool stuff happening, at least in these animal models. And
all of those that you mentioned are 12, 16, 18, 20 time-restricted feeding windows. Again, not caloric restriction, chronically lowering calories.
Yeah. And so I think that that's important. It doesn't have to be caloric restriction. I wanted to bring this study up just because I think it's a really fun one. And you can tell me what you think about this one. Like you said, I think that the majority of what we want to talk about in this podcast is intermittent fasting, kind of just changing the windows in your diet. And I want to get your thoughts on caloric restriction in general. But I found this one. I thought you'd appreciate it. Have you seen this one of Angus? This is the longest fast ever. Have you seen this case report? 382 days.
I don't think it's in the book. I made it in the book, but yeah, I have heard of it before.
I mean, it's just such an amazing thing. So this is where fasting can go at the extent, but we're not talking about this, but this is a guy who, a 27-year-old male who literally fasted under medical supervision for 382 days. And we'll put the link in the show notes, guys, and you can see, but he lost a ton of weight. You can find pictures of him online. It's super striking. There were many electrolyte changes and he did need some medical intervention at times, nothing major, but I mean, you can fast a long time if we are massively obese, but what we're just talking about here is not even that type of fasting, just intermittent structuring of the gut and other things. So what are some of the other benefits of fasting that you came across when you were doing the book? We talked a little bit about the microbiome restructuring. There's tons of other ones, right?
Yeah, totally. So it's going back to Paracelsus' words of this physician within. I mean, there's so many exciting, far-reaching cascades of cool things that can happen in the body with this. So a lot of this is centered around, and if you look at the studies around the ketogenic diet and fasting, it's because they're both supporting beta-hydroxybutyrate. You're going to see a lot of the same mechanisms. Beta-hydroxybutyrate is increased during types of fasting. Ketogenic diet is mimicking fasting in many ways. So a lot of the same ways that beta-hydroxybutyrate, you're going to see parallels between ketogenic studies and fasting studies. So beta-hydroxybutyrate is a signaling molecule, helps to lower inflammation, which is most of my patients that they're struggling with chronic inflammatory problems. So to be able to support endogenously this natural potent anti-inflammatory is profoundly important. So that honestly, I mean, most people when they hear about fasting or even the ketogenic diet, they're most excited about the fat loss side of things, which is certainly very exciting for many, many people. And it's a natural byproduct of becoming more metabolically flexible. But the anti-inflammatory benefits are what I'm most geeked about. Lowering things like NF-kappa-B, lowering things like the NLRP3 inflammasome, all this, the neuroinflammation that's going on in our society today, the amount of people that are struggling with even low grade to extreme degrees, they're somewhere on that neuroinflammatory spectrum, whether with things like anxiety and depression and brain fog and fatigue. This is a way to naturally lower brain inflammation, upregulating these pro-antioxidant pathways like the AMPK pathway, the NRF2 pathway, supporting autophagy pathways, supporting stem cell activity, improving BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factors, looking at neuroplasticity in the brain's ability to regenerate and become more resilient, improving mitochondrial biogenesis, actually making more resilient mitochondria. So these are the things that I need as a clinician to be more optimized for my patients. I need them to move the needle in a significant way. So this is something that I get to see on an almost hourly basis, the people just taking this tool of intermittent fasting, and that's completely free, that works in profoundly amazing ways. And I just keep going back to Paracelsus. How the heck did this dude know thousands of years ago, this physician within, he knew it. And now science is catching up with what he said. That's why these guys are the fathers of medicine. I'm not, but it is, it's really cool to see this.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I mean, the benefits are profound. One of the other things that I've heard you say on our podcast, which I really appreciated, was that you can go too far, right? That there's a balance here. And you talk about this in the beginning of the book, that there's this kind of, it makes so much sense. I mean, we can get all hand wavy and woo woo. And I'm in Costa Rica right now, and I'm podcasting from a place that has a yoga studio just to the left of me. So there's a lot of chakras and chi floating around. There's a lot of yoga, namaste, but you get it. Like, we can talk about that. But I do think that there is something to a balanced yin and yang within, you know, like within a human cycle, within eating and fasting. And I think that we can go too far. And this is actually one of the mistakes that I made with the carnivore diet and ketosis myself, was that I stayed in ketosis personally way too long. And so I guess the question for you is, do you think someone can stay in ketosis too long? Because we're talking about ketosis now. Yeah. Beta-hydroxybutyrate does appear to be a good thing, but do we always need it, right? Is it just kind of this, use it sometimes and then come off? Talk to me a little bit about this balance between AMPK and mTOR and this kind of back and forth.
Totally. Yeah, I think the context around this, it's so important. And we all, you know, as human beings, when something works for us, we get excited about it because it's done amazing things. And then, but the goal is, how do we use this amazing tool of all these tools that we're talking about in a way that serves us long term? And you can use amazing tools therapeutically for a time. And then what does the maintenance phase look like once we've kind of really used an amazing tool to get out of the weeds, to really get out of a dangerous place when it comes to their health? And then it doesn't mean you abandon it. It doesn't mean that it doesn't work for you long term. But what does maintenance mode look like with intermittent fasting or any with the ketogenic diet? And I think that when specifically with the ketogenic diet, ketosis, intermittent fasting, these are hormetic things. These are states of hormesis that are, it's good stress that makes our body more resilient. And just like high intensity interval training, just like sauna therapy, just like cold therapy, all these things are good. They're all hormetic effects, but I wouldn't stay in an ice bath all day long. I wouldn't, you know, be in a sauna all day long. I wouldn't be doing burst training all day long. And fasting all day long is starvation. So it is that balance. It's striking that balance. It's looking at the context of what we're trying to do here and improve our quality of life, improve how we feel, or improve our labs, like whatever we're trying to do here. So I find that depends on our starting point. Like, I'm meeting people at different points of what they've tried, how much is going on here. So we can use an amazing tool of deeper ketosis, deeper times of fasting therapeutically for a time. But then we get to the point where leptins come down, inflammations come down, the gut's reset, the body's feeling amazing. And then that's part of this intuitive component, is that we start to check in with our body to say, look, like, I'm good to diversify things a little bit. I want to cycle some things back in and to still have that be my center. But I've created a center for myself. I've created a center of metabolic flexibility. And because I've created that center, I have a lot more flexibility to pivot in and out of it. And that's that grace and lightness that I want people to find for themselves. And we all have our own capacity to pivot that are it's different. It's bioindividuality. Some people are better in longer term ketosis. Some people, it serves them well because they're going to get way more benefits in that state. And when they experiment and try to pivot, they don't feel as good. And that's okay. They're using that therapeutic benefit of ketosis to maybe help with their neurological symptoms, help with their autoimmune symptoms, whatever reason that you're talking about. But most people actually benefit from a more of a cyclical approach, periodic times, even seasonally. I think if you take a more of an ancestral health perspective, I think that people can have this ebb and flow with their physiology. So what I advocate in the book is to do clean carb cycling for women around their periods. Ketotarian, I mentioned doing it seasonally as another tool. I think people can experiment and play around with it because there's a time and place from a bioindividual standpoint to increase clean carbohydrates that work for your body, and check in with your body. How's your energy? How's your sex drive? How's your sleep? How's your digestion? How's all these things? If it's working for you, keep doing it. But if some people are like, no, I felt better when I was in lower carb or a ketogenic state, I felt better with these more of these deeper fasts, then keep doing that too. So it's okay. And here's the bigger part of the conversation. What serves you now isn't necessarily what's going to serve you in a year or two. Your health is going to continue to evolve and adapt. Your gut's going to continue to heal. So be okay with pivoting. Be okay with evolving as your health improves.
I love that. And I found that with my own health journey, that reincorporating carbohydrates was an improvement for me, and that cycling ketosis generally on a daily basis now, or a semi-daily basis, depending on the eating window that I'm using, seems to work best for me. And I've seen this over and over with people, and but there is some nuance here, right? For people who are frankly diabetic and frankly metabolically disordered, ketosis is a great place to be. Getting rid of the carbs is a really good thing. But then hopefully once we can get back to some degree of metabolic flexibility and or metabolic health, reincorporating them may be good long-term. And those who are metabolically healthy, I think, don't need to fear carbohydrates. I see so much black and white thinking and dogma within the ketogenic communities. And it really bothers me because there are people out there just saying that carbs cause diabetes and all carbs are bad. And I think, what are we talking about? Like, are you crazy? It's not true.
No, look, and the clean carb cycling that I'm advocating for people, you hear that word carb cycling or carb loading, and people think of like the bodybuilder or like specific athlete, and they're like binging on like refined carbohydrates and stuff that's really not going to be good for the average person, right? What I'm advocating for is literally going up to 75 to 150 grams of carbohydrates from whole foods, from real foods. And you don't even need to be super granular and measure all the carbs out. I'm just saying more or less, that's where I find the sweet spot for most humans. That's an average paleo level of carbohydrates. It's nothing crazy, but it's enough to really support a lot of things and to strike that balance for that person's physiology.
Yeah, and interestingly, I've found that region to be what I usually end up at as well as a human.
Yeah.
And I think that's good for people to know. 70 to 150, I think, is a great region of carbohydrates for most people in a day. And some people use metrics like, oh, start out at 90 and then you have to earn more than that based on how active you are. Yeah. So for me, if I'm surfing for extra hours, I'm going to have a few more carbohydrates. It does seem to be reasonable, but that 90-ish mark seemed to be when things got better for me and I would cycle in carbs. And so for me, what I've found to be the best carbs may not be the ones that you agree with, but I'll get your thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. I really like fruit, and fruit's become demonized recently. And I like honey. Now I'm metabolically healthy, but I like the sweeter, simple carbohydrate carbs without the starches and the fiber. Those are the carbohydrates that I've found to work best or feel best for me. But what do you think about that versus when you're saying clean carbohydrates in your book, what are you advocating for? Whole foods, but what kind of stuff?
Totally. Higher fructose fruits, exactly what you said. So in the lower carb, obviously, you know this, but people, I mean, berries, lower fructose fruits can be part of that sort of lower carb and ketogenic world, keeping your carbohydrates under 50 grams, 20 grams of carbohydrates a day. But you're going to be able to have more of that and more diversity of fruits that are higher in fructose and other sugars. All the fruits are completely fine. And honey, maple syrup would be two other choices. And it's potatoes, starchy tubers can be fine too. But to your point, I find that some people that with digestive issues, they don't do well with lots of those, but same could be said with higher FODMAP fruits too. So depends on the case, but the point is I'm advocating for people in intuitive fasting to, and for my patients for that matter, to experiment with these different types of starches. And I would say even, I'd like to get your thoughts on this too. I find that, and I don't do this initially, but for the book, I did it for the sake of simplicity because I'm not there to manage the case. Even gluten-free grains like rice, I find that some people, some women do fine with those. They enjoy it. I do the white rice, so it's lower in lectins. It's easier to digest. And some women like it. They really like it around their cycle. It gives them diversity, and they pivot from that center.
Yeah, I mean, white rice is super controversial. Anytime I talk about eating white rice, people vilify me because I'm so about ancestral things. So I had to kind of check myself and be like, yeah, you're right. White rice isn't so ancestral, but I mean, it didn't bother me a whole lot. I don't use it in my diet right now, but I've definitely heard, I mean, people that work with me at Heart and Soil are sometimes eating white rice and they seem to make it seem like it's easy. So I mean, gosh, it's probably pretty low lectin. It's basically amylose. It's a glucose polymer. There's not a lot of fiber in white rice. It's probably reasonable for some people. So it's interesting to kind of play around with these carbohydrates and face the dogma head on. But, you know, I recently had Stephen Gundry on the podcast and we didn't have enough time to really get into this, but do you have any concerns about fructose in these amounts found in fruit and honey? Because he's quite concerned about those. I'm not, but I wanted to get your thoughts.
Not in the amounts that we're talking about, not 75 to 150 grams of carbohydrates a day. No, I've never seen it be an issue for people that are eating within that realm. Do I see people that don't feel as good in those higher amounts? Like you said, the diabetics, some of them, even if they got a even if they move the needle significantly, they have metabolic flexibility, they still feel better with being on the lower end of that scale of what I talked about. So even if they go up, you know, 50, 60, 70 grams of carbohydrates, they're fine there. But the upper limits of that 150, yeah, if you're having that amount of sugar, if you're insulin resistant, if it's fructose, I could see that being problematic, especially with things like agave nectar, which is higher in fructose. But the whole food fruits in its whole food form, I find it to be less problematic, but doing even on the higher level of that 150 for somebody that's insulin resistant, it's not that it's going to be they're going to be like flared up and back to square one, but they're not going to feel as good. And that's the intuition that I'm talking about. When you feel so freaking good, you've created a center for yourself. You love feeling better more than you miss that food. So you're like, I'm okay. I'll cut it down a little bit. Come go to the low end of that scale, still enjoy some fruits, not freaking out about it, and you're fine. We have to find our center and pivot from there. So I'm not afraid of fruit sugar. I think it's fine, but people need to be mindful of not more isn't always better. You have to find that sweet spot. No pun intended.
It's a good pun. I just think that there's some conflation and reductionist thinking in communities, in the low carb communities, saying, well, we can look at many studies that compare fructose to sucrose to glucose and see differences in de novo lipogenesis in humans. And so therefore people say everything with fructose is bad. And I think, whoa, not so fast. Like high fructose corn syrup is probably not the same as a papaya. It's just probably not. Like there's things in the papaya or things in honey, nitric oxide intermediates that affect the way our body processes this. And it's to conflate those, I think, is dangerous and evolutionarily inconsistent, because clearly our ancestors were eating fruit. I mean, in Tanzania, when we got honey, we ate the crap out of it. It was delicious. And they were not worried about it. They were not saying, oh, I've had too much fructose, I'm not going to eat this honey that out of this tree. So evolutionarily, it just seems like we've had it. And when people in the health space are suggesting things that go against, they're just clearly against what we would have done evolutionarily or what I imagine anthropologically would have been true or historically, it just kind of gives me pause. And I think really, like, it just doesn't make sense to me. So it's interesting. And I just, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page for sure.
Yeah. So this is an article I wanted to show, which I got from the references in your book, which I thought was great. People can find this one from the New England Journal of Medicine. And it has, I mean, it's a pretty preeminent journal, and they talk about intermittent fasting elicits evolutionarily conserved adaptive cellular responses integrated between and within organs in a manner that improves glucose regulation, increases stress resistance, suppresses inflammation. And they go into a lot of this in this paper. You can see the mechanisms here. And I thought this chart here was particularly interesting. People can see this on the YouTube video, or there'll be a reference in the show notes, but they contrast, maybe you can walk us through this. We've done this a little bit. Let's contrast periods of intermittent fasting with periods of recovery and sleep, eating and sleeping over here. So let's just go through this for people. So we talked about ketones and I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. So what they're doing on this chart for people that have seen the video, it increased ketones, beta hydroxybutyrate that I mentioned, and acetoacetate, increasing mitochondrial biogenesis, or they say increasing mitochondrial stress resistance, increased antioxidant defenses. So that's going to be things like the AMPK pathway, the NRF2 pathway. I think that's what they're referencing here. Increased autophagy, increased DNA repair, decreased insulin, decreased mTOR, and decrease protein synthesis. And then below that, it says resistance of cells and organs to stress, metabolic, oxidative, and ischemic and proteotoxic. So what we have under periods of recovery, it's basically the opposite of that, right? It's increased glucose, increased insulin, increased mTOR, increased protein synthesis, increased mitochondrial biogenesis. So we're seeing the opposite of that. So it is definitely... Yeah, I think there's a time for both. And I think it's striking that balance, right? And more isn't always better. Like mTOR, I think you mentioned that earlier, is that we need mTOR sometimes. It's not something that lower mTOR isn't the name in the game all the time. But I think most people, their mTOR is always high all the time. And that's where the problems lie. And I think a lot of these anti-disease, pro-longevity benefits of fasting comes into the modulating mTOR. But super low mTOR for the rest of your life isn't the name of the game either.
And I think that's where some folks in the quote longevity space take it too far. Again, they're making the same mistake. It's like they'll say, well, meat or leucine or amino acids or carbohydrates activate mTOR. And we know, you know, overactivation of mTOR, perpetual activation of mTOR in a Western diet's a bad thing. Therefore, we should just never activate mTOR. And you go, wait a minute, what? That's not true. Like, you know, these are guys like Valter Longo. I've had this discussion with Stephen Gundry in the past as well. Like, I think if you cycle back and forth, and I believe we'd agree on this, it's okay to stimulate mTOR sometimes. We need that for growth and repair. Yeah. And then you want to be back on the other side and kind of have the other side of the equation where you're doing rest or where you're doing repair and sort of this autophagy. So one of the things in that chart that I thought was interesting, you brought this up in the book, was the DNA repair. Talk to us a little about that, because that's an important one with NAD.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, I mean, most people are they're because of this incongruency, because of this growing chasm between genetics and epigenetics, a lot of the dysfunction has to do with the fact that our body's not able to repair. We're constantly digesting food, and we're constantly digesting food that's very inflammatory, very disruptive to the microbiome. So our body's constantly trying to like bring things back to center, where we're making it very difficult on our body. So by allowing this sort of house cleaning system of the body to upregulate and start to repair our protein, start to improve our mitochondria, start to improve upregulating and supporting things like autophagy, it's one of the confluence of factors that are at the heart of why fasting can be so healing for people over time. And that's kind of the conversation that I'm having in that in week 3 in the protocol, the cellular renewal pathway, which I'm really talking about the sirtuins and NAD and the longevity benefits and autophagy and all of that stuff. It's not to say, well, in 1 week, we're going to be creating these things, but this is something for you to use as a tool in your toolbox as a lifestyle practice, to start to find periodic times, find times of these deeper ketosis, of deeper fasting to repair, to calm things down, to pause stuff for a bit, to allow our body to heal and to regenerate. To go back to something that you touched earlier on that I think is what I tried to create within the protocol and the message for people to really get is that macro variability and eating window variability, I think is like magic stuff. It's good for humans to realize that variability is a good idea. And I almost, the analogy that I use in the book is this sort of proverbial yoga class for your metabolism, is that we ebb and flow and vacillate from these spaces, whether that's changing macros up, shaking up our eating windows. When we shake things up, I find that it modulates the body in really cool ways. So that's what I'm trying to say through the book and the message that I'm trying to get across is the state of balance.
Yeah, I love it. And I think that really comes through and I really appreciate that. And like we said, we see that evolutionarily. We see that in hunter-gatherer cultures. And I think that it just makes so much sense that we don't need to worry about eating protein or meat as long as we give ourselves some time to just not do that occasionally, whether that's on a daily basis or a quarterly basis or whatever, that if there is this ebb and flow of these both sides, it's such a simple retort to the argument that you're going to overstimulate mTOR with meat. It's like, wait a minute, no, because I'm not eating for 16 hours a day. How am I overstimulating mTOR? Like you can check my fasting IGF-1 in the morning and it's going to be low. Whereas, you know, an extended eating window and always eating, we're just countering the standard American way of life.
And I think that I've always appreciated with you is that you've showed your labs, you showed the data of where you're at, and no one can really argue with that. It's so easy for people to sit there on social media and pontificate and be like on their high horse, but it's like, okay, let's look at labs. And that's what I do on an hourly basis. That's what you do too. It's like the numbers aren't lying. And you look at the data really improving somebody's health. You just need to shut up if you really can't say much beyond my labs look great. I feel great. What are you against here?
Yeah. What are we worried about? What are we even talking about here? And to that point, I've been very fascinated recently by visceral fat. And in these kind of pseudo debates that I'm having with people, I had Joel Fuhrman on the podcast last week and then Stephen Gundry. I always kind of want to ask them, like, can you show me your visceral fat? Like, what's your IGF-1, right? Because I'm pretty convinced that a lot of these people in the plant-based space or these vegans specifically would have more visceral fat than I do. And yet there were, why are we even talking about all of these? We can get all this argumentation about diet and this study and that study and observational studies, but it's like, let's just look at how healthy an individual is who's doing this type of diet. Again, it's just N of one versus N of one, but I think there's some validity to that. And you talk about that a little bit in the book too. Are you aware of any evidence regarding fasting or intermittent fasting and visceral fat? Or is it just kind of like, we think it's going to improve this?
Yeah, I did touch upon it on one of the five key components of fasting chapter. Yeah, it looks like we know with beta hydroxybutyrate, there's a lot of lipolysis, a lot of fat burning that's going on. And over time, that's one of the things that I want to be seeing clinically is visceral fat coming down. So there's emerging studies coming out of the journals looking at that. And I have no doubt that in another decade, we're going to have so many other cool studies looking at the powerful tool of beta hydroxybutyrate, whether that's through a ketogenic approach or fasting or both, and the ability to lower visceral fat and lower all these cardiometabolic things that I want to get optimized for my patients.
Yeah. So one of the other things that you talked about in the book that I thought was interesting was the statistic that when people do calorie restriction, it's this infinitesimal number of people who are actually successful in losing weight, right? I think this is the study, right? This is the one?
Yeah.
Yeah. The probability of an obese person attaining normal body weight, it was like one in 210 and one in 124 for women. And this is just with regular caloric restriction. Mm-hmm. Like these eat less, move more fails, right?
Yeah, it fails most people most of the time. And we keep going back to it. It's like the definition of insanity. And we keep thinking that it's going to solve things. And that's one of the initial critiques I think people have around intermittent fasting is they are conflating it with caloric restriction. Or they're thinking, well, that's the benefit of it. It's just because you're cutting calories. And that may be a fringe benefit. I think that cutting some excess calories can be beneficial, obviously. But that's not the main mechanism here. We're not trying to rebrand the diet culture with intermittent fasting. That's really not the goal here. So something that I've said for years, but I say in the book is you have to get healthy to lose weight instead of trying to lose weight to get healthy. And many people are like that, like going to diet and starve themselves into health. There's only so long until you give up because it's miserable and you're still stuck in sugar burning mode. You just took the kindling off the fire and you are fatigued and hangry and with insatiable cravings. Because you never put a log on the fire because you've never actually shift the way your body is using fat for fuel. So I'm all for people to experiment in this. And there's a time and place for that clean kindling that I talked about with clean carb cycling, et cetera. But you have to put a log on the fire. You have to get fat adapted to get some sustainable energy. And I think that's why people that eat the way that I'm advocating for variability, becoming fat adapted, experimenting with a ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting, it's sustainable for most people because it's A, enjoyable, B, you're eating lots of good food, you're not starving yourself, and you feel great and that encourages you. So I think that's why the opposite is true for more conventional diets.
I really like that. You have to get healthy before you lose weight. And so many people get stuck in these dietary frameworks, Weight Watchers, and they're just calorically restricting and it just fails. And there are people in the nutrition space who just continue to say the benefits of any diet are caloric restriction. And you think that's just so, I think that's myopic because that's discarding any attention to micronutrients, that's discarding any attention to the potential benefits of or negative effects of seed oils, the benefits of the unique nutrients and animal meat and organs, in my opinion, these type of things. There's just, there's no attention to food quality when you're just restricting calories. And then you get these statistics that one in 210 men and one in 124 women is actually able to keep weight off when they do that. That's baloney, man. That's a non-tenable strategy. And I love this idea. Get healthy in order to lose weight, actually change your metabolic health as you are doing this. That's the key. And that's a really different framework. And it doesn't even have to start with any sort of caloric restriction. I think it just starts with, like we talked about, fixing the gut, changing the gut by giving the gut a rest period, changing the micronutrients you're getting, eliminating the toxic foods. And then it's going to be so much easier to find satiety and actually achieve a sustainable caloric deficit, if that's what we need, or change your overall metabolism and change the calories in, calories out.
Exactly. I think obviously calories are part of the conversation, but they're not the whole conversation. And that's the thing too. People are so, it's interesting. It's such an antiquated thing, but there's still a major movement, and fasting is a trigger for many people, many different groups, where they think that's where we're coming from. And that's what, not what the science is showing. That may be a component of it for some people, but it's not the totality of the healing benefits that we're talking about here. And like I say in the book, our body is more of a chemistry lab and not so much a calculator. And people need to realize this, calories in, calories out. I mean, we know this, but like 500 calories of garbage versus 500 calories of avocado or like grass-fed beef is not going to be the same thing. These are instructors to our biochemistry, instructors to our hormones, instructors to our microbiome. And how is it instructing?
Exactly. And that's, I think that seed oils are such a good really crystallization of that. And you talk about that in the book, and you recommend that people avoid the seed oils as well. But you just can't say that 100 calories of canola oil is equivalent to 100 calories of tallow or animal fat, which is my favorite fat. They're just not the same in the way they affect our mitochondria, in the way they become part of our membranes and cardiolipin, in the way that they affect everything, LDL composition and oxidative stress, just all the signaling that happens in the hypothalamus. They're not equal. So we have to really think about this. The food quality matters. It's just not something we can ignore.
Exactly. It's like, and you can't even say, when you look at NMR tests, you look at nuclear magnetic resonance tests, and you see all day long people taking it from these high small dense LDL particles, pattern B, high triglycerides, and you see all that dissipate in a couple of months, in like 3-4 months. There's no conversation beyond that. It's like you see these people's cardiometabolic markers improve exponentially over a relatively short period of time. It probably took them decades to get to where they're at. We can rebound that. The resilience capacity happens pretty quickly for most people. And just by changing these simple things, they're not really changing their calories at all. None of my patients are. They're eating the same amount of calories that they ate before. They're just changing the quality of food and these eating windows. And we can shift not just NMR panels, but lots of different markers.
I love it. That same point came up in my conversation with Sean Omaro when we were talking about these MRIs that he does and looking at visceral fat. And he showed these images of this patient that he had that completely melted away their visceral fat, which is the intraperitoneal fat. This is not the subcutaneous fat that jiggles on our belly. It's the fat that's around our organs within the peritoneum, around the kidneys, or specifically around the intestines more accurately. But this is the type of fat that is really an indicator of overall metabolic health. It's just this really litmus test for it. And he would see this change, and the guy did no exercise. He didn't do any caloric restriction. All he did was change the quality of foods in his diet. Yeah. And over 6 weeks and then 35 weeks, he completely lowered significantly the amount of visceral fat, and all of the correlated improvements in metabolic health happened. And so it doesn't even have to be. I love that you're saying you don't even have to think about caloric restriction if you change the quality of the food and incorporate the eating windows.
Yeah. And I should probably clarify a little even more. A lot of my patients, they're actually eating way more than they used to eat.
Really? Wow.
It's like a trippy for them, because they're like, what the heck? I was like so concerned about like tracking things on my Fitness Pal and like having the 1300 calories. Like this, they almost feel guilty eating more. And then they see their weight dropping and they see their markers improve. They're feeling better. It's shattering that diet culture that they think they have to restrict. They have to starve themselves, you know, proverbially, they have to decrease the amount of calories to see positive improvements. I can't tell you how many people I've heard that over the years is that I've never eaten more in my life and I'm actually losing weight and I'm actually improving my biomarkers. And I think a lot of your listeners will probably attest to that as well.
Man, isn't that the coolest thing? That's the way it should be, right? That's the way it should be, because like you said, then you're not in a dietary prison. So I know you've got to go, but as we wrap up, last question, stumbling blocks, things to look out for when people are doing this, as they're transitioning to intermittent fasting, what are some things to look out for? Sleep issues, et cetera? Is it different for women? Let's just try and give people some idea of the speed bumps that might lie in front of them.
Sure. And I talk about this at length throughout the book. I really put my clinical experience throughout the book to know when you hear people do things all day long, you know how to, hey, if you're feeling like this, do more of that. If you're feeling like that, do less of this. So there's a lot of modifications and tweaking I put throughout the book. But look, I start the book off, week one is just a 12-12 time restricted feeding, which is in the fasting world is not like the sexiest way to fast. But to me, I think it's very underrated because it's just going back to the adage of don't eat too late at night. Allow a couple of hours to happen if you can after you eat dinner. Before you go to bed, to allow your body to fast through the night until you break the fast at breakfast. And there's really cool studies around just a simple 12-12 TR time-restricted feeding window. And I think that is kind of the message of the book too, is that more isn't always better and rushing into something isn't always better either. Because sometimes I feel like, to use that yoga analogy, if someone's metabolically inflexible, my hamstrings are tight, I'm not super flexible, I go to an advanced yoga class and I could say, whoa, what the heck? Like, yoga's not for me. There's something wrong with yoga. No, I'm not. I'm just rushing into something that my body's not ready for. And that's the same way I want people to figure with this, is that I made a 4-week protocol in the book. And I say in the book, maybe you need to repeat week one for 2 weeks, maybe even 3 weeks. It's okay. Like, set yourself up for success. And I find that some people get, with good intentions, overeager, and they want to rush through it. But leaning into it, as long as you're progressing, even incrementally, we're trying to make this a lifestyle change, not some fad crash thing. So I would say allow your body time to become more metabolically flexible. And then, because a lot of things are happening, microbiome changes, metabolic changes, mitochondrial changes, we want to make sure that you're well hydrated. You want to make sure you're sleeping well. You want to make sure, look at your stress levels. We want to be supporting electrolytes through that metabolic adaptation. So there's a lot of resources in the book for people to really tap into these amazing benefits that we've talked about through this conversation without falling prey to these potential pitfalls. Because then people think, oh, this isn't for me. Well, no, it's not that at all. It's just like that yoga class. You just have to figure out, maybe you're doing things that's not right for your body at that time. And you just tweak some things to make that practice work really well for you.
Yeah, everybody's going to arrive at this at a different level of metabolic flexibility, aka metabolic health. And we can all get on the spectrum and adjust. And I think that's a great way to start doing this. So thanks so much for your time, brother. It's good to see you. Man. And I can't wait to take you to have you come with us to Africa soon.
Here I come, Hadza.
Let's do it, man. Let's do it.